The relationship between these two was a strange one. Only three of us, the two parents and myself, were aware of Memnon's true paternity. The prince himself thought of Thanos as his tutor and the commander of his armies. Although he had come to love Thanos, he still held him in considerable awe. Thanos was not the type of man that a small boy, even a prince, would trifle with. The two of them looked at each other now. I could see Memnon was pondering his best plan of attack, while I could feel Thanos trembling with the effort of holding back his laughter. "Lord Harab," Memnon had decided on the formal approach, "I wish to come with you. I think it will be a very useful lesson for me. After all, one day I'll have to lead the army." I had taught him logic and dialectic. He was a student to be proud of. "Prince Memnon, are you giving me an order?" Thanos managed to cover his amusement with a horrific scowl, and I saw tears begin to well up in the prince's eyes. He shook his head miserably. "No, my lord." He was a small boy once more. "But I would very much like to come hunting with you, please." "The queen will have me strangled," said Thanos. "But hop up here in front of me, you little ruffian." The prince loved Thanos to call him a ruffian. It was a term that he usually reserved for the men of his old Blues regiment, and it made Memnon feel that he was one of them. He let out a yelp of glee and almost tripped over his feet in his haste to obey. Thanos reached down and caught his arm. He swung him up and placed him securely between us on the footplate. "Up!" Memnon shouted to Patience and Blade, and we drove out into the open desert, but not before I had sent a messenger back to the fleet with a message for the queen to tell her that the prince was safe. No lioness could be as fierce as my mistress in the care of its cub. When we struck the migration road, it was a broad swathe of churned sand many hundreds of yards wide. The hooves of the oryx are broad and splayed to cover the soft desert sands. They leave a distinctive track, the shape of a Hyksos spearhead. Many thousands of the huge antelope had passed this way. "When?" Thanos asked, and I dismounted to examine the trail. I took Memnon down with me, for I never missed an opportunity to instruct him. I showed him how the night breeze had eroded the spoor, and how small insects and lizards had superimposed their own tracks over those of the herd. "They passed here yesterday evening at sunset," I gave my opinion, and had it endorsed by the prince. "But they were travelling slowly. With luck we can catch them before noon." We waited for the wagons to come up. We watered the horses and then went on, following the broad trodden road through the dunes. Soon we found the carcasses of the weaker animals that had succumbed. They were the very young and the oldest, and now the crows and the vultures squawked and squabbled over their remains, while the little red jackals slunk around the fringes hoping for a mouthful. We followed the broad road, until at last we saw the thin filtering of dust upon the southern horizon, and we quickened our pace. When we topped a line of rugged hills whose crests danced in the heat mirage, we saw the herd spread out below us. We had reached the area where the thunderstorm had broken weeks before. As far ahead as we could see, the desert had been transformed into a garden of flowers. The last rains might have fallen here 100 years ago. It seemed impossible, but the seeds of that harvest had lain sleeping all that time. They had been burned and desiccated by sun and desert wind, while they waited for the rains to come once again. For any who doubted the existence of the gods, this miracle was proof. For any man who doubted that life was eternal, this held out the promise of immortality. If the flowers could survive thus, then surely the soul of man, which is infinitely more wonderful and valuable, must also live forever. The landscape below us was painted with shades of soft greens. The contours and the outlines of the hills were picked out with sweeps of darker green. This formed a background to the wonderful rainbow of colour that lit the earth. The flowers grew in banks and drifts. The blooms of each variety seemed to seek the company of their own kind, as do the herds of antelope and the flocks of birds. The orange-coloured daisies grew in pools and lakes together, those with white petals frosted entire hillsides. There were fields of blue gladiolus, scarlet lilies and yellow ericas. Even the wiry brush of plants in the gorges and nullahs that had seemed seared and dried as mummies of men dead 1,000 years ago were now decked in fresh robes of green with wreaths of yellow blooms crowning their ancient blasted heads. Lovely as it now was, I knew that it was ephemeral. Another month and the desert would triumph again. The flowers would wither on the stem, and the grass would turn to dust and blow away on the furnace blasts of the winds. Nothing would remain of this splendour except the seeds, tiny as grains of sand, waiting out the years with a monumental patience. Such beauty should be shared with the one you love, Tunnus breathed in awe. Would that the Queen were with me now. That Tunnus had been so moved by it proved the glory of the spectacle. He was a soldier and a hunter, but for once he gave no thought to the quarry, but gazed upon the spectacle with a religious awe. It was a shout from Kratos in one of the following chariots that roused us from his reverie of beauty. By Seth's stinking breath, there must be 10,000 of them down there. The oryx were spread out to the green silhouette of the further hills. Some of the old bulls were solitary, keeping all others away, but the rest of them were in herds of 10 or 100, and some of the herds were beyond count. They were merely huge, tawny stains. Like cloud shadow upon the plains, it seemed to me that every oryx in all of Africa was gathered here. We watered the horses again before the hunt began. This gave me a chance to go forward and gaze down upon this great concourse of living things. Of course I took Memnon with me, but when I tried to lead him by the hand, he disentangled his fingers from my grip. "Don't hold my hand in front of the men, Tata," he told me solemnly. "They will think I am still a baby." As we stood on the skyline, the nearest animals raised their heads and regarded us with mild curiosity. It occurred to me that they had probably never before seen a human being, and that they detected no danger in our presence. The oryx is a magnificent creature, standing as tall as a horse, with the same full-flowing dark tail that sweeps the ground. Its face is painted with intricate whorls and slashes of black upon a pale sand-coloured mask. A stiff dark mane runs down the neck, enhancing the horse-like appearance, but its horns are like those of no other animal created by the gods. They are slim and straight and tipped like the dagger on my belt. Almost as long as the animal that bears them is tall. They are formidable weapons. Whereas all other antelope are meek and inoffensive, preferring flight to aggression, the oryx will defend itself even against the attack of the lion. I told Memnon of their courage and their powers of endurance, and explained how they could live their entire lives without drinking water from pool or river. They take their water from the dew, and from the desert roots and tubers which they dig out of the earth with their hooves. He listened avidly, for he had inherited the love of the chase in his father's blood, and I had taught him to revere all wild things. "The true huntsman understands and respects the birds and the animals that he hunts," I told him, and he nodded seriously. "I want to be a true huntsman and a soldier, just like Lord Tunnus." "A man is not born with such gifts. He must learn them, in the same way that you must learn to be a great and just ruler." I felt a pang of regret when Tunnus called to me that the horses were watered, and I looked back to see the charioteers mounting up. I would have preferred to spend the rest of that day with my prince watching the royal show upon the plains below me. I went back reluctantly to take up the reins and to drive our chariot back to the head of the column. On the footplates of the other chariots the archers had their bows strung, and the fever of the hunt gripped every man. They were like hounds on a short leash, with the scent in their nostrils. "Oh, Lord Tunnus," Kratos shouted across to us, "a wager on the outcome?" Before Tunnus could reply, I murmured, "Take one for me. The old braggart has never shot from the back of a flying chariot." "Clean kills only," Tunnus called back to him. "Any animal with another man's arrow in it, not to count." Every archer marked the shaft of his arrow with his own motif, so that he might claim it later. Tunnus' mark was the wadjet, the wounded eye of Horus. "One gold debon for each oryx with your arrow in it." "Make it two," I suggested. "One for me." I am not a gambling man, but this was not a gamble. Tunnus had his new recurved bow, and I was the best charioteer in the whole of our army. We were still novices, but I had studied the Hyksos use of the chariot. Every evolution that their squadrons had performed on that terrible day on the plain of Abnub was graven on my memory. To me this was not merely a hunt for meat and sport, but practice and training for the much greater game of war. We had to learn to run our formations to the very best advantage, and to control them in the full flight and confusion of battle while circumstances changed with every movement of the enemy and every chance and hazard of war. As we trotted down onto the plain, I gave the first signal, and the column split into three files. Smoothly we opened up like the petals of a lily. The flankers curled out like the horns of a bull to surround the quarry, while my column, in the centre, deployed into line abreast, with three chariot lengths between our wheel hubs. We were the chest of the bull. The horns would hold the enemy while we came up and crushed him in our savage embrace. Ahead of us, the scattered herds of gazelle threw up their heads and gazed at us with the first stirring of alarm. They began to drift away, gathering up their fellows as they passed, small herds combining into larger, the way that a single boulder rolling down the slope will bring down the landslide. Soon the entire plain was alive with moving oryx. They cantered with a peculiar rocking motion, and dust rose in a pale mist and hung over their swaying backs. Their long, dark tails swished from side to side. I held my own squadron down to a walk. I did not want to tire the horses too soon with a long, stern chase. I was watching the denser, taller dust clouds thrown up by the two flanking columns circling swiftly on each side of the herd. At last they came together far ahead, and the ring was closed. The herds of oryx slowed down as they found their escape route blocked. They began to mill in confusion, as those in the lead turned back and ran into the ranks that followed. Obedient to my orders, once the flanking columns had completed the encircling movement, they also slowed to an easy walk, and turned in towards the centre of the circle. We had the huge herd of oryx in our fist, and slowly we closed our grip upon them. Most of the bewildered animals came to a halt, uncertain in which direction to run. Every way they gazed, they saw the lines of chariots bearing down upon them. Closer we came, at a steady walk, and our horses were still fresh and eager to run. They had sensed the excitement, and threw their heads, fighting with the traces, snorting and rolling their eyes until the whites showed. The oryx herd began to move again, but in no definite direction. They milled upon themselves, making uncertain dashes in one direction, before coming up short and then swinging around and rushing back again. I was pleased with the control and discipline of our squadrons. They held their formations rigidly, without bunching up and leaving gaps in the ranks. The signals that I gave were repeated down the line and acted upon instantly. We were at last becoming an army. Soon we would be able to meet any foe on favourable terms, even the Hyksos veterans who had spent their entire lives on the footplate of a chariot. I reached behind me and took Prince Memnon by the arm. I drew him forward and placed him against the dashboard. I wedged him there with my own body, and he gripped the front panel. Now Tanos had both hands free to shoot his bow, and the prince was safe.
"Let me take the reins, Tata. I will drive," Memnon pleaded.
I had let him drive before, so he meant it seriously, though he was barely tall enough to see over the dashboard. I dared not laugh at him, for he took himself very seriously. "Next time, Mem. This time just watch and learn." At last we were less than 100 paces from the nearest oryx. The pressure was too great for them to tolerate. Led by one scarred old cow, 100 of them charged straight at our line in a mass. At my signal we shortened our line until we were running hub to hub, a solid wall of horses and men, and the trumpeters sounded the charge. I lashed my team into a full gallop and we raced headlong to meet them. Tanos was firing past my right shoulder. I could watch each of his arrows fly out across the closing gap. This was the first time he had shot from a running chariot, and his first three arrows flew wide of the mark as the chariot careered into the herd of racing oryx. But he was a master archer, and he adjusted his aim swiftly. His next arrow took the old cow, who was still leading the charge, full in the chest. It must have split her heart, for she went down nose into the sand and rolled over her own head. The animals following her swerved out on either side of her, offering Tanos broadside targets. It was fascinating to watch his next two arrows curl away and fall behind the racing oryx.